For those of us with an interest in economics, it is a daily struggle to see so many of the key lessons from classical economics, some of which have been widely known since 1776, so keenly ignored and sometimes outright flouted by members of the political class and their various cheerleaders. This is not necessarily a matter of left versus right, because it doesn't matter if you're Labour or Tory, Democrat or Republican, the economic facts don't change, and we see routine and persistent illiteracy on both sides. In this video, I'm going to do my bit to try to redress that balance by sharing six of the key lessons from classical economists. I want to do my best to equip anyone who sees this to tackle much of the nonsense they will see said on both sides of the political divide. It doesn't matter if it's Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders, Theresa May, Vince Cable, or Jeremy Corbyn saying it. What matters is if they are thinking primarily for the best outcomes for the economy as a whole, or primarily in terms of what sounds good, and accordingly, what might win them votes from special interest groups. So let's begin. The first lesson comes from the man himself, Adam Smith. Wealth is not money, but a measure of the goods and services in the economy as a whole. What we call today the standard of living. You could be sitting on a massive pile of gold, as does the dragon Smaug in J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit, but this does not give you wealth if you have nothing to spend it on. In real terms, even some of the poorest people in 2018 Britain, with their mobile phones and access to huge amounts of cheap food and so on, have more wealth than some of the richest in medieval Britain. This is because Smith analyzes what I'd call the underlying economic reality rather than simply the flow of money, which brings us to his second key insight. The economy is not a zero-sum competition in which one person's gain is another's loss. This common fallacy, which many people still have even now, suggests that the only way that somebody could acquire lots of money is by taking it, whether by force or so-called exploitation, from somebody else. But this is simply not true. If I buy an apple from the apple merchant, he's gained a gold piece from me, but I've gained an apple from him. The money I give is not simply in exchange for the apple itself, it is also in exchange for the time and effort the merchant has put in to having the apple picked from a tree and transported to the marketplace. The total wealth here is that he ends up with one gold piece and I end up with an apple. How did I get my gold piece? Well, maybe I'm a butcher and I got it from selling meat. Now some other person has the meat and I have an apple, and that gold piece is still in the economy with the apple merchant and whatever he spends it on. We all win. My customer, me, and the apple merchant. Such is the wealth of nations. The third point is international trade is not a zero-sum game either, because comparative advantage leaves everyone better off in the long run. This is David Ricardo's famous insight. This, put very simply, means that the idea that maximising exports to the detriment of other nations is a fallacy. Let's pretend Britain was making wine, and in order to compete with France and protect our own vineyards and wine cellars, we levied a massive tariff on imports of French wine, trying to hurt our foreign rivals. But what does this mean in practice? It means that the average British person now has access to fewer bottles of wine at higher prices. Ricardo's insight is that it would be better to remove tariffs and allow the French wine to come in. But, some might cry, that might put our own vineyards and wine cellars out of business. Well, so be it, this might be the case. But if the French can take on the burden of making that wine for cheaper than we can, fine, let them shoulder that cost, and we might not only reap the benefits of the cheaper wine, but also reallocate our own resources to more productive means. Let's say in the production of iron and steel. Now the French economy is wrapped up with making wine, and we can make steel and sell that to them. And what happened? Both Britain and France end up with more wine and more steel at lower prices than they would have done having a trade war over the wine. And this is comparative advantage in a nutshell, which remains the case for free trade even today. Number four is Say's Law, which says in order to demand goods, you must first supply goods. You cannot simply demand something into existence. For centuries, people had worried that growth could reach a point where the output of an economy would exceed the ability of people to buy it, leading to unsold goods and unemployed workers. But according to Jean-Baptiste Say, this is not true. Rather, the production of output and the generation of real income for those producing that output are not processes independent of each other. Let's go back to our little market. Remember, our apple merchant is supplying apples, the butcher is supplying meat. In short, the only thing that allows me to buy the apple is because I sold the meat, and vice versa. Now, there's an awful lot of confusion around Say's Law, because John Maynard Keynes butchered it and gave it the form of supply creates its own demand. Keynes took Say as suggesting that this means there can never be a glut of a given product, or that there can never be anyone out of work. This isn't what Say says. He says that there can never be a general glut, which means overproduction of all products, because if there's an overproduction of one good, that means that some other good isn't being made. Let's say I pack in the butchery business and become an apple seller too, and this creates a general glut in the apple market. It comes only at the expense of the meat market. Say's Law also suggests that there are no theoretical limits on how big the economy can grow because goods and services create chain demands. Let's say our apple merchant makes so much money he needs to put it in a bank. That creates demand for a bank. Let's say that in the winter he needs somewhere to store his many apples. That creates demand for a warehouse, and so on and so forth. There's no real limit to how big that chain can get, and this, in a nutshell, is Say's Law. One of the most routinely misunderstood economic concepts, and buried in this is a fifth lesson from classical economics. Every part of the economy is connected to the whole of the economy, so small changes in one part will reverberate throughout the economy. Leon Walras. Now, this comes from general equilibrium theory, which we need not worry ourselves with. What's important to grasp is what Henry Hazlitt calls the long-run effects of any intervention in any part of the economy. Virtually no economic transaction takes place in isolation. Here's an example from Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics. You can find this on page 613 of the 5th edition. If you put a cap on interest rates that can be charged on particular kinds of loans or on loans in general, this will likely reduce the total amount of loans that are made and change the mixture of people who can get loans, lower income people being particularly disqualified, as well as affecting the price of corporate bonds and the known reserves of natural resources, among other things. So even though to many, capping interest rates that banks can charge on loans looks like taking an action that will only affect banks and lenders, in fact, it affects the whole economy. This puts pay to the notion that you can create particular solutions to particular problems in economic affairs. A change in one place necessarily affects changes elsewhere, which is why you will often hear advocates of the free market talking about market distortions. Another aspect of this is the phrase popularized by Milton Friedman, "There ain't no such thing as a free lunch." Since the economy is this holistic system, the idea that anyone can get something for free is an obvious nonsense. Someone, somewhere, always pays, whether in money, opportunity cost, or jobs. The money spent by the government, let's say on building a bridge, is money not spent on everything else. And this is an example that Henry Hazlitt has in his book Economics in One Lesson. This is on page 33. If the bridge costs $10 million, the taxpayer will lose $10 million. They will have that much taken away from them, which they would otherwise have spent on the things they needed most. Therefore, for every public job created by the public project, a private job has been destroyed somewhere else. We can see the men employed on the bridge, we can watch them work, but there are other things we do not see because, alas, they have never been permitted to come into existence. They are the jobs destroyed by the $10 million taken from the taxpayers. All that has happened at best is that there has been a diversion of jobs because of the project. More bridge builders, fewer automobile workers, television technicians, clothing workers, farmers. We can see the bridge, but we cannot see the unbuilt homes, the unmade cars and washing machines, the unmade dresses and coats, perhaps the ungrown and unsold foodstuffs. And so, Hazlitt shows us, the real costs of the bridge are much more than simply the $10 million because of the long-run effects on the economy as a whole. The sixth lesson is that of marginal utility, which is simply the charge that both the value and utility are entirely subjective. In older economic theories, a value was said to be determined entirely by the cost of production, that is, the total cost of labour plus the total capital investment. But this is not true. As we see practically every week on shows like Dragon's Den, you can spend a lot of time, money and effort on a project and still nobody will want it. And if nobody wants it, its value is zeros. Let me tell you where I am. I'm out. What both Karl Menger in Austria and W. Stanley Jevons here in good old Blighty pointed out, separately and independently, but around the same time, which is the 1870s incidentally, is that even use value is subjective. An example might be a glass of water. What's the value of a glass of water? To a man in the desert dying of thirst, he might give everything he has for it, but to someone who has just drunk a pint of water, rather less. Hence we get the idea of marginal utility. Water, after the first glass, incrementally loses its value, and hence it can be worth less, ultimately, than something a lot less useful, but more of a luxury item, such as diamonds. Value is subjective, and prices are simply a measure or expression of that value in money, as determined by supply and demand. I might really value something, but everyone else may not agree. That might mean that I end up paying less for that because I have less competition to buy it. But in all likelihood, it'll mean that I end up paying more for that thing because, being a niche item, it is unlikely that there will be many suppliers, which will therefore push up the price. This is why it's generally cheaper to be into something that lots of people do than it is to be into something obscure and esoteric. The latter will very likely be in short supply. Now, watchers of this video will do well to learn the six basic lessons from classical economics. Just these few insights alone should insulate you from a lot of the nonsense that you will see and hear in both politics and daily life. Let me run through them again. Number one, wealth is not money, but a measure of goods and services in the economy as a whole. Number two, positive sum gain. The economy is not a zero-sum competition in which one person's gain is another's loss. Number three, comparative advantage. International trade is not a zero-sum game either, because free trade leaves everyone better off in the long run. Number four, Say's Law. In order to demand goods, you must first supply goods. You cannot simply demand something into existence. Number five, general equilibrium. Every part of the economy is connected to the whole of the economy, so small changes in one part will reverberate throughout the economy. Number six, marginal utility. Both the value and utility are entirely subjective. Let me quote Henry Hazlitt once again. The bad economist sees only what immediately strikes the eye. The good economist also looks beyond. The bad economist sees only the direct consequences of a proposed course. The good economist looks also at the longer and indirect consequences. So, my friends, get equipped with the tools to tackle the sophistry you will see everywhere in life from people who don't look past the ends of their own nose. Till next time. I'd like to thank Son of Tiamat, The Crimson Satyr, Charles Vinson, Edward Darrah, Graham Leggett, Michael Burt, Slaughter Otter, Ginger Bill, and Blake Barrows.